Everybody on tape? Good. You taping right now? All right.
Earth on the Air is bona fide, honest to God, public radio.
It's a bunch of different things.
It's definitely hands-on radio.
It's grassroots radio.
Grassroots radio. I mean, it's the entire plant, but it's mostly the roots.
It's looking at the connections between the environment and society.
It's Earth on the Air. In the next 30 minutes, a report by a computer programmer from Quebec about a third world village in Denmark. Prophecy from a native elder. A chat with another elder, environmental and human rights activist Hazel Wolf, plus Gary Snyder, and much more. First, these bits of tape collected in Seattle about Tibet's struggle for independence from China. We'll start with a recent candlelight vigil.
I'm a Tibetan, and my country was taken by the Chinese because they're much more powerful militarily. And in terms of also population, and my country is very, very peace-loving. So I thought this is a small contribution for tonight's candlelight vigil.
To show your anger?
I don't show anger because from very childhood I was taught patience, I was taught compassion, I was taught the feelings of others.
Plan, which calls for the whole area of Tibet, not just the autonomous region, which China just calls Tibet, the whole area of Tibet to be a zone of peace, a buffer zone, a place where there will be no armies, and for the Chinese to stop the immigration of their people into Tibet, because that is threatening of survival.
You think that could happen with public pressure from around the world?
Yes, we think so. And the United States can do that, can express our concerns by revoking most favored nation status. That's one step that our government needs to do.
China and Tibet, from the culturally very different, and we have separate language, and geographically they are totally two different countries. So since they are different, I want to be different. I don't want to be my own country, second-class people.
The scope of destruction in Tibet is absolutely amazing.
Photographer Galen Rowell produced a book recently alongside the Dalai Lama. It's called My Tibet.
Out of 6,000 monasteries that were there before the communist invasion in 1950, all but 10 were destroyed when I arrived in the first time in 1981. 1.2 million Tibetans were killed during the Maoist regime out of 6 million Tibetans.
Teacher Gary Wintz and his wife were the first Westerners to actually live and work in Tibet since the Chinese occupation. That was in 1982.
Tibet's the roof of the world. It's the highest country on the face of the earth. The average elevation is 15,000 feet. It's a whole nother climate up there, extreme continental climate. The sky is as blue as you can find anywhere in the world. It's the eternal land of snows. The highest mountains in the world, there are 40 peaks that are over 23,000 feet. And the people are quite different also. A lot of the people are nomads. You would think you're stepping back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years in time. And the Tibetan people are very warm people, very casual people, extremely happy people despite the tough repression they have been under since the communist invasion. They, in a way, are our protectors that overlook the entire planet.
One of the things that is happening is that the environmental movement is now becoming concerned with Tibet for the first time. They're realizing that there's been a great environmental disaster that is reversible at this point. There are no species in Tibet that I know of that have become extinct, but there are a lot of species that have lost maybe 95% of the numbers. They're all there in little pockets, and if things can be turned around in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, there's hope that Tibet could have it all over again, and that's what the Dalai Lama would like to see. The difficult aspect is to separate, or is not to separate, human rights and the environment anymore in Tibet. That, unfortunately, our American organizations are very factionalized. And when they've looked at the Tibetan issue, a human rights organization says, really, that's too much into politics, or that's too much into the environment. The environmental organization says, no, that's not for us. That's not an environmental issue. That's human rights, or that's political. And they're all tied together. They're all part of one thing in Tibet. The invasion by the Chinese not only took away a lot of human rights from the people, including starvation, imprisonment, and forced sterilization of women, and on and on and on and on, in terms of things that have happened to human beings, but also set about rampant destruction of wild creatures in a place that more than anywhere in the world, including our national parks, had a fantastic relationship between human beings and nature, where the Buddhist people in Tibet had an attitude of complete nonviolence, an attitude that all sentient beings were equal. And just in a geological instant, that changed when the Chinese invaded.
Next on Earth on the Air, a computer programmer from Quebec made this recording at a third world village in Denmark.
Hi, this is Jean-Paul Bardou talking to you from Aarhus, the second largest city in Denmark. I am in a building called Ridehuset, a huge old riding stable turned into a convention center. This first weekend of February 1991, an unusual event is being offered to the public. This place was turned into something looking like a run-down street somewhere in the third world. Sand was strewn all over the ground, and metal siding adds to the favela look. I talked with one of the organizers. What do you call this event?
In Danish we call it I en helt tredje verden. In English it means another third world. There is a double meaning in it. We have played with the words. We want to show another world, and we want to show the third world.
What is the objective?
We want to show beauty from the third world. How to be able to live in happiness with less material goods. We have also connected the third world development crisis and the environment problem. We have done it because there's a natural link between them. You cannot solve economic problems without enormous consequences for the environment. For instance, if the Chinese began to use toilet paper as we do, the world forest would be exterminated. We would like to encourage people to do something more.
Can you describe some of the activities taking place here today?
Yes. At the same day, you can visit a Vietnamese tea house, an African village, an Indian house from Nicaragua, a beautiful exhibition from the Rainforest Group. The audience is very welcome to touch things. In that way we are different from other exhibitions. They are welcome to take up the challenge they meet in the exhibition. And they can bring along their attitudes. We'll try to give them some new attitudes, but they can pick up the attitudes themselves. We won't hit it into them. In short terms, the audience would get something home to wonder about.
Jean-Paul Bardou sent us that report from Denmark, where he currently works as a computer programmer. He asks us to reconsider our assumption that modern technology has made things cheaper. What's the real price of cheap, writes Bardou. Basic laws of physics tell us the full price has to be paid one way or another. If we don't pay it, somebody else will. He gives a few examples. The miracle of plastic diapers that stay with us 500 years or more. Clean and cheap nuclear energy
that leaves a trail of deadly waste thousands of years long, or industrialization in general, which carries the hidden cost of reducing workers' daily lives to, as Bardou puts it, repetitive steps that have been purposely stripped of all meaning in a search for efficiency. Hence, the third world village he visited was not built to induce pity for backward societies, but to celebrate what these cultures have to offer undeveloped.
This is Earth on the Air.
There's a book out called Power Shift. It's by Alvin Toffler. The premise is that we've entered into an age where speed is the only thing that matters anymore. It's the survival of the fastest, and slow cultures better learn to get on board or they're just not going to make it. Poet and bioregionalist Gary Snyder, who lives in Northern California, was asked about Power Shift.
Well, there's the whole story of the tortoise and the hare. And I can hear what that says, and I can see it, you know, on many levels. The information economy, the post-industrial, this and that. Centralization of markets, you know, zap, and $1 goes all over the world in a nanosecond. At the same time, the really slow cultures, like the Hopi, that maintain a certain kind of sustainability, economic sustainability in some slow, dumb way of their own, and a real sense of their own identity, don't lose their sense of identity, will probably still be plugging away, you know, when these other guys get tangled up in their own speed. And how speedy can you get is a good question. At what point does speed become a hindrance or not a help? I love working with my word processor, but I have to confess that it has exactly the same effect that agribusiness has, industrialized agriculture. It doesn't save you any time. You don't have any more leisure. You don't have any more free time. All you are is more productive. That's what they, you know, that's what agribusiness does. You work harder, but also you produce more. But labor-saving devices, as they say, never saved anybody any labor. They just make you more productive. So you have to discipline yourself, I guess. You have to be your own monitor at the point of, when am I going to stop doing this? And slow down. And that's exactly to the point of logging. 40 or 50 or 60 year rotations are too fast in the woods. We would have absolutely no problem if everything was tuned to, say, 200 year rotations. You know, it would slow it down, but not that much. Because once it was in place, you know, everything would be coming up every year. Something would be 200 years old.
The Adventures of Value Chicken.
But he doesn't have any feathers.
Don't touch that dial.
Ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest. Resplendent, irreplaceable networks of cosmic harmony. Or expendable, God told me to go and conquer the planet, tree farms. Today we join Value Chicken in the nucleus of one of these few remaining shreds of primal beauty.
Psst, no feathers.
Who, me?
Yeah, you. Who are you anyway?
I'm Value Chicken, and my views do not necessarily represent those of this station. Say, aren't you an old-growth tree?
Yeah, well, actually I am. Pretty impressive, huh?
Share with me the wisdom of the ages.
Wisdom, huh? I'm not that wise, actually. But then, not much happens here. You know, a fern grows, an acorn falls. Maybe I haven't been paying attention, but it's really kind of dull.
No, you're the oldest living thing on Earth. You possess the secrets of the cosmos, the wisdom that comes...
A stitch in time saves nine. Happy?
A stitch in time saves... Maybe I should try that. You must be saved.
Hey, did it ever occur to you that we don't want to be saved? I'm bored stiff, and I want to be bored feet. Hey, that's kind of catchy.
Yes, it is, but I thought you were part of an essential, complex web of life.
No, that's a commonly held misconception. Actually, I want to be cut down. I live to be harvested. It's my purpose. Then I can provide computer paper and Dixie cups and fruit juice boxes to a fast-paced yet grateful world.
Maybe it is okay to cut you down. I do like those Dixie cups with the animal jokes on them.
So do I. Why save me? Last year, Weyerhaeuser planted 15 million trees. 15 million trees! It makes you think, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. There's something under here.
No, there isn't anything
it's
under here.
Let me take this off.
I'm a tree. What do you take it off? I'm a tree.
It's a person.
No, how many people have bark? I mean, I'm a tree.
You are a person. You're a person dressed up like a tree. I thought it was a little odd that you were thousands of years old, yet barely 6 feet tall. You imposter.
Yes, Value Chicken, it's me, John Q. Archenemy, your archenemy.
I have an archenemy? How flattering.
You foiled my public relations plot, Value Chicken, but I will be back. I will be back.
Archenemy, what an interesting job.
It's not that interesting, actually.
What kind of a school do you have to go to?
Well, I didn't
And so Value Chicken saves the forest from a deadly corporate public relations flux. Join us next time for another episode of
Value Chicken.
Value Chicken is the creation of Seattle-based independent Tom Bear and freelance writer Brent Hardinger.
But tell me, where are we gonna work when the trees are gone? Say, will the big boss have us a wash his car? Or maybe mow his lawn? I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a lumberjack man. But I fear it ain't for long. Tell me, where are we gonna work when the trees are gone?
That's the man who's known as the Woody Guthrie of the West Coast, Earth Firster, Daryl Cherney. Next on Earth on the Air, Hazel Wolf, union organizer in the 1930s, founder of an intertribal coalition between environmentalists and natives, citizen diplomat to Nicaragua and the Soviet Union. Hazel Wolf was once asked whether she believed in revolution. Which one, she replied, the one in 1776, that was a good one. Wolf had a chat recently with Janice Kane, who's a student of botany at the University of Washington.
In Seattle lives a modern-day heroine by the name of Hazel Wolf. Hazel is 93 years old and still very involved in her community. She's an activist for old-growth forests, serves on the board of the Seattle chapter of the Audubon Society, and is often asked to speak at environmental events and lectures. Hazel is special. There's a magical, realistic charm about her, which can bring a person down to earth.
And when that gets dark enough, you know, jiggle it around. When it gets dark enough, put it in there.
Okay.
Here's the graham crackers.
I spoke with Hazel Wolf one Saturday afternoon while sipping tea.
What would you say are your greatest achievements?
Oh, reaching age of 93.
What's your secret?
Oh, don't ask me that. I got all kinds of flip answers. One is I have no television.
You don't watch TV?
No, because I think television is full of vulgarities, misinformation, bumper sticker news, which I'm not interested in. I just have nothing in common with the television programs.
Have you ever watched TV?
Well, when I go to people's houses, I watch TV. I saw my first glimpse of the war not too long ago. That was the blazing oil wells. And here's this tremendous blazes in the background, some little figures running around in the front, and this great cloud of coal black smoke all going that way, and I kept thinking, suppose the wind changed, what's going to happen to these people? And that's the first glimpse I had of the war.
You call yourself an organizer, a motivator.
An organizer, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, how about the guy who watches football Sunday afternoons?
With his six-pack? Yeah, well, I like a six-pack, too, but I'm not going to watch a football game. What to say to him?
Yeah.
Nothing. Something's going to knock him over the head one of these days. But it won't be me. I don't waste time on things that I'm not going to be able to accomplish. And these people that are obsessed, it's almost an addiction. It's like dope. You know, these people just are addicted to the television, to the exclusion of almost anything else. Rome did that, didn't they? What did they have, bread and circuses to keep the citizen's mind off what was going on. Do you feel that TV is like that? The programs? Yeah. What else? I'm trying to get all the youngsters to drink this awful Coca-Cola and these soft drinks.
Would you see that as an evil?
Yeah.
Where are we going?
We're going in the direction of a better world. But we have a lot of things to overcome. And we'll stumble and fumble and on our way there, as we have done up through the ages.
So after health, what would be a goal for Hazel Wolf?
Well, to do whatever lay in front of me to do. Oh, here's something I'm involved in. Yeah, this is what I'm hoping to do. The environmental movement is 100% white, middle class, fairly affluent people. And they don't plan it that way. It just is that way. It comes from their historical, from their origin. And we've talked about this a lot in Audubon. We're contacting the leaders in different ethnic groups and seeing if we don't have something in common that we can work on together. And I think we have a lot of things. Take city parks, for instance, in Seattle Audubon. See, I explained this to one of our Afro-American leaders and he thought it was the funniest thing he ever heard of. Seattle Audubon is basically an urban chapter. And we have field trips in the city parks to listen to the owls at night. We call them owl prowls. You don't go in the city parks at night anymore for owl prowls, or you'll get mugged. You'll run into drug people. And neither do the people in the communities go anymore at night. So I says, there you are. We have that common thing to make our city parks safe for the community that live there and for the owl prowlers. So that's an example. And we all breathe the same air. And we all listen to the noise pollution. And if we get together, we'll find all kinds of things. All kinds of things.
So if you're out late at night in a park and happen to see a tiny white-haired lady hooting at the moon, just stop and say hello to Hazel Wolf.
This is Earth on the Air. Harold Belmont, or Flying Chief, is known as the spiritual leader of the Puget Sound area Suquamish tribe. In his living room one afternoon, he offered to tell me a 200-year-old prophecy about how the white people and the red people would one day learn to work together. For a visual aid, he used a talking stick passed down to him by his father, on which the elements of the prophecy had been intricately carved. The 4-foot wooden stick had once been painted bright colors, but now was faded and looked like a museum piece.
Good, hold it. Just hold that end. Hold that end there. What I'll do is I want you to visualize in the sticks in your left hand, we could say that that's the beginning. In the tail of the serpent here, we could say that this is the end. And if you can visualize the beginning and the end, you should be able to visualize a circle or a sacred hoop. We're talking about the sacred hoop of life itself. And if you understand the sacred hoop of life, your left hand is on the beginning, my right hand is on the tail. And if you can visualize that circle or that sacred hoop, there is no beginning or there is no end. Or the end is the beginning and the beginning is the end, because we're talking about the continuation of sacred life itself. But in that sacred life itself, there are things that we need to learn. And here on the bottom, where I had my right hand, is what we call the white serpent. That's you guys. You guys are no good. This is the white snake. You're a white snake. But on the back of the white snake are some black dots, and that represents the struggle of our black brothers and sisters. Because it was prophesied that our black brothers and sisters would have a struggle too. And the same thing is true of the white snake. And all you have to do is to look at the people of Appalachia, and you'll know that there are white people back there that have gone through the same kind of difficulties that any other poor people have gone through, whether they're white people, black people, or red people. So that's the significance of this white snake. It's just to symbolize the common struggle that we have experienced. And just above the white snake is just what we call the red serpent. This is worn now, but this should be painted really nice red. This represents the red people, the native people. And it symbolizes the struggle of the people. And in the prophecy, the way the struggle was symbolized is this eagle. You could see the wings of this eagle here. But the eagle is kind of upside down, and it's been decapitated. And on the wings of the eagle, there are three spans. This is to be painted red, this is to be painted yellow, and this is to be painted green. And this was the symbol of death, the eagle with no head hanging upside down. But the significance of this prophecy is shown right here. Through this eagle, if you can see it, it looks like this is supposed to be a knife. But if you examine it closely, you'll see it actually looks like a cross right here. This is what killed that eagle. And that was that first European, or that was that church that come here that said that this way of life was heathen, pagan, and savage, and needed to be civilized and needed to be Christianized. And this is what actually killed that culture or that way of life. But you can see through this struggle here, whether we're talking about the red people, the white people, or the black people, if we can go through this process, you can see right through here is that this is the same eagle right here that it's come back to life. And it's standing there, and it's got that serpent in its mouth. It shows a victory for the red people, the white people, and the black people. Because we begin to see collectively is that if we know the cardinal directions, the north, the south, the east, and the west, that this is inclusive of the human family or the human race. That's why it's important for us as Native people to get over our rage for the white man and begin to see that the white man is much our relation as the red man or the black man or the yellow man. So the lesson there is that it's all of us. You and I are brothers so that we can begin to find that commonality of objective. And it's shown to us in the prophecies is that we have to set aside this separatism or this difference, and we need to become as one. And we see that the purpose of that is shown to us in this fire. Because this fire here, the Christians, in their understanding, they connotate it as the end of the world. We don't see it that way. We see when the Mother Earth has been subjected so long to so much, she's not going to end herself. But Mother Earth is going to purify herself with water, with rain, with wind, with fire. That's what this symbol is. And so this is really a warning message to the people that, yes, indeed, there is a struggle. But there is an opportunity to heal and to change.
Sister and brother equal in our mind.
You've been listening to Earth on the Air, radio by people like you, for people like you and the rest of the planet. We appreciate your comments, and even more, we appreciate your participation. You can write us for tape submission guidelines at Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. That's Earth on the Air, Box 45883, Seattle 98145. We had additional help from Scott Bergen, Susan Gleason, Craig McDonald, Laura Lee, Kathy Bloom, and Bill Svoboda. Music was by David Hines, Daryl Cherney, Michael Greiner, and Randy. Our show was produced in Seattle with the help of Jack Straw Productions, KCMU-FM, and KSER-FM in Linwood. Partial funding was by the New Roadmap Foundation. For Earth on the Air, I'm Peter Maloff.